Hey Sahil, welcome. It's great to have you on. You know, I feel like you'd be on the internet enough times you cross each other's path, but here we are, finally putting something on the books. So welcome to the podcast. It's great to see.
Thanks so much, Sahil.
Video form.
It's you
dimensionality to our conversations.
Yeah, truly. And so it's you know, the we've been on the internet, like doing various things for such a long time. For sense of context, almost everybody that listens to this, if they have heard of you, will have heard of you from Gumroad. I was just checking the traffic on it and the number of backlinks. It's just like a truly absurd number, like I've never seen in my entire life. And but the story wasn't always sexy. Do you want to give like a short version of your bio? To that you would give a complete stranger or an interested stranger, and then maybe we can go from there.
Sure. Yeah. So I moved to the Bay Area in 2011, January of 2011, to work at Pinterest as employee number two. I built, designed and built Pinterest for iPhone. And then one weekend, I had the idea for Gumroad. I wanted to sell something I had designed to my Twitter audience and found that basically there was no real easy way for me to do that. And that's kind of where Gumroad came from, is I just wanted to kind of build something that solved that problem for myself. Stripe had just sort of announced their existence. So I reached out to John, got a beta key and built this prototype and put on Hacker News, and it went viral and raised money and raised another round of funding. And kind of Gumroad sort of famously or, you know, or infamously raised a bunch of venture capital, Kleiner Perkins letter A, which Kevin and I have that sort of in common. And then in 2015, we failed to raise our Series B, downsized the company, you know, did layoffs, got to profitable. And then I kind of ran it by myself, kind of on autopilot. The business kind of continued to grow. And so I moved to Utah and kept running Gumroad. And then, you know, it's funny because that's kind of the end of the story. But I think what's compelling to people is that, you know, and this essay I wrote about it that went viral is just about this idea that you kind of, there's this binary outcome in venture capital. And the term people have used historically is a unicorn, right? Like you're looking for these billion-dollar outcomes. And if you don't hit that, it's kind of the equivalent of a zero.
You're useless.
So just kind of going through that process and being public about it and making a commitment now, I guess, to kind of doing everything in public. Like I think if that would like, I kind of consider that like the death of Gumroad, where it's sort of like now I'm in the afterlife. But now it's kind of like I'm in extra time. I can have a little bit more fun with like actually doing like what, you know, what I want, given that like, you know, we kind of suffered that defeat or whatever. So anyway.
How did that actually work with, so Kleiner obviously was on your cap table and you're like, I want to do this myself. How did that work, that process for you to take back? And I think did they give the shares back to you? Did you buy them out and they just kind of wrote it off? How did that work?
So basically, you know, in 2015, we realized we weren't going to raise the round. And so we kind of just said, you know, I'm going to keep running Gumroad, get to profitable, and I'll see what happens. And then Mike, who was on our board, left Kleiner. And so he left the board and was like, at some point, Kleiner will, you know, nominate somebody else. But you know, we don't need somebody right now. And then basically I was, you know, 2 years later, 2 years passed and I just kind of kept doing that. You know, it was just running Gumroad, like on autopilot, hired someone to do the floor. It was like hiring contractors, like just kind of doing it. And I actually pinged investors a couple times saying, hey, look, like, does anyone want, we have some profits, like you want to get, you know, a 1x on your investment or whatever. And then Kleiner had actually said no a couple times. And then randomly, you know, at the end of, near the end of the year in 2017, they basically reached out and said, hey, we're looking to like, we'd be interested in basically selling our entire position back to Gumroad for a dollar.
Wow.
That's awesome. That's really awesome of them.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people have said it's probably because of a tax write-off, like there is some financial benefit.
Yeah, for sure.
An amazing thing that basically, like, had they not done that, who knows? Like Gumroad would just kind of be in the zombie mode for indefinitely, right? Like I really didn't have that much motivation to keep working on it. The company has 16 and a half million in preferences, about a million in revenue. And so it was like,
that's interesting.
You know, I owned a good part of the company, but you know, it just, it was kind of underwater for a long period of time. And Yeah.
So really. you were down to work on it if it was 100% yours or close to 100% yours, but with 16.5 million on the pref stack, you were just I'm kind of making it 0 to 1, but I'd love to hear some nuance from you that sure. was like, you would be like, well, fuck it. I'm not working for these guys. That's an extreme version of it.
Yeah. Basically, I was running this thing and it was doing about $2 million in revenue, maybe like $50K mm-hmm. a month in profit or something like that.
Yeah.
And had, you know, 16 and a half million in preferences. And I was like, I just don't see any return on, like, at any point.
Sure.
What happened.
Yeah. Right.
And it's growing about, you know, 20, 30, 40% a year. So it's kind of just, it is growing. And it's sort of a great business if the cap table was clean, but it wasn't. And so I just mm-hmm. kind of want to learn. And then Kleiner's last, they did a bridge, which was $2 million at 4x preference. So
okay.
it's more, you
know, whoa. Wow.
Damn.
Ouch.
We had raised we needed the money. So it
sure.
And I'm sure, you know, to be honest, probably a lot of these rounds happening or will happen.
Mm-hmm. Right? You mean in the future now?
In the future now, exactly.
Yeah. I hear you.
And so, you know, founders should know about what a non 1x preference may look like, right? When they wrote off the position, what it meant was we went from 16.5 to 2.5. So effectively, we became a sort of pre-seed or seed fund company again.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of incentive wise, I was like, okay, cool. If I can sell this business, you know, a few years from now for like 5 million, 10 million, 15 million,
sure.
You know, it may be worth something. And then obviously COVID.
About the math. The math is you had 16 million in pref because you had 2 million on a 4. So that brings you to the 8. And then on top of that, you had another 6 or something. And that 6 was the 6 million that they originally put in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. Got it. Right. And then it's like a million from, you know, 2 million from just other investors.
Yeah. Yeah. This is strong inside baseball, but I'm enjoying it. And so basically you got this 16, because when you got a strong big pref stack, Kevin had one. Right. I'm pointing because he's over here for me.
Yeah.
I had a fucking big prep stack. And so I hear you about that motivation. But the important part also is that your business, when we talk about Gumroad, was self-serve, and it was generating its own. Every time someone built something, they naturally shared the link, of course, which is super powerful. And every time that they shared it, they might even have blogged about it. So you generate a link to your own fucking website. And like, it had a kind of self-reinforcing engine that, should you give it enough time, I'm telling you this, I'd love the correction of the story, but it feels right to me, is that you should just give it enough time. Like, it's just going to do what the internet does, which is either kill something, drop it to zero, or it's going to slowly grow it to infinity. Does that resonate with you?
100%. Yeah. I think there's some sort of basic physics happening in the market
where there's,
you know, some amount of people getting onboarded to the internet, some amount of those people are going to want to do, you know, sell a PDF or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. And Gumroad is sort of the de facto default for that, just like Patreon might be a default for another type of behavior or Substack for another type of behavior. And so that sort of compounding, I think, was sort of there early, but the numbers were so tiny. And mm-hmm. articles are still quite small, or we're doing about 200, you know, less than 200 million a year in GMV.
Yeah,
it's still significant, but it's still not a home run for Kleiner, even if they had had
it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's just like this long, drawn out thing that I think might take 30, 40, 50 years. But I mean,
sure.
You look at MailChimp or Basecamp or some of these, like, you know, super slow growing companies,
mm-hmm.
WordPress or something like that. It can, you know, 20, 30 years in, you're sizable. Off that 10%, 20% yearly growth.
It's a little bit of like, kind of like, you don't see this in new internet, I feel. New internet is like, take venture, explode, or die. The thing dies, start over, fuck it.
Yep.
Old internet is like, I feel like blogger.com, where it's just like, so there's just a lot of people doing it. And given enough time, compounding is just powerful. And it's just that venture naturally doesn't give that time. Right. And it actually penalizes it.
Yeah. I mean, I would say almost something similar happened with maybe like finance, right? Where it used to be more the Berkshire's approach was common. And then there's so much incentive to this, like, focus on yearly returns. Mm. And everyone starts compressing their timeframes. And so it just inevitably becomes like, even if you look at Gumroad and say, hey, if this business grows, like when I show people the math on just Google Sheets, I'm like, hey, I have this thing. It does 200 million GMV. It could grow 20, 30% a year, which sure. in startups, like no one would consider that even interesting. You just do the math, and we've been around for 12 years. We do have a good amount of data. And the numbers can get quite astonishing. But even in venture, which people sort of, you know, there's an association with, you know, patience and this long-term thinking, even there, I think there's cut it off at 10, 15 years for certain kinds of businesses that have this self-reinforcing engine to it.
Yeah. Right.
It's going to network effect and get more and more powerful. There's just basically, you should just never sell. That was kind of my position with Gumroad, and maybe a different person other founders would have taken as they would have sold. But for me, I'm like, yeah, but I like doing this. And so I'm just going to have to do it again.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of hard parts to doing this that I don't really want to do again. And so if I can just wait, wait 5 years, right? Like literally what I told people, I'm like, what if I just wait 5 years? Obviously, I didn't predict COVID and other things that 2x, 2.5x the business in a couple of years.
Right.
It's sort of like nothing surprising. If you just look at the chart for Gumroad, like creators with sales, you know, it's like we crossed 30,000 in January, and this is after the pricing increase. And it's just basically every month, it's just like more and more and more and more creators, right? Like, I think it would be hard for us to mess that up. It's sort of like Twitter. Like it's hard to mess up.
The clown car the clown car that drove into a gold mine by Mark Zuckerberg's quotations. So kind of like, it doesn't really matter. Like the numbers are working in our favor type of thing.
I'm curious.
You're surfing on, you know, autopilot.
I'm curious. Why do you think that these types of things don't happen a lot? So I had a similar type of thing that happened to me with Ship. So our prevalence stack was $63 million. And like, there was a realistic, we were pivoting. We had our new business that we actually didn't launch. It was doing very well. Like our growth was great. And that eventually turned into Airhouse, which we're doing fantastic. But like the willingness for a new investor to come in and like to clean up the cap table and like have a pay to play and like get rid of the preference stack and everything, like that's just doesn't happen. So
it's hard, but it's also
impossible to really get done. Like investors would rather that something go to, I wouldn't say all investors, but like it's easier for the thing to go to zero and for you to start over than trying to like clean up this mess, even if they are going to be able to take some stake in that, even if it is they're taking their percentage, their whatever they invested, and now they're only going to have a 1% ownership in this, and they would have had 10% before, whatever it is. It's interesting that this doesn't happen more often, and I'm really surprised that it got happened with you, Sahil. I don't know if it was the partner that left Kleiner, and Kleiner is just like, yeah, whatever kind of thing, but like typically this does not happen, and I think that it could happen for a lot of other companies. Like you hear now, like we're in 2023, there's going to be so many companies that are going to have to do down rounds. They're going to have to do recaps, and a lot of them won't be able to get it done, and they'll just go to business. But there's probably still a good business in there. Why do you guys think that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it requires a lot of agency to make happen. Mm-hmm. It's the very different path. To your point, not a lot of people do it, and I think even like Twitter, using Twitter as an example, it's sort of been out there as a target for sort of a leveraged buyout for a long period of time. It's been run, you know, like a clown car. And sort of if you just slash, you know, it's not a surprise that like what Elon has done has kind of worked, at least balance sheet wise. But I think you just need, like, you can't get enough people to agree on, like, you can get everyone to agree.
That's it.
Yeah, that's true.
But you can't get everyone to agree that you're the one to fix it and they're
right.
You know,
right.
And your approach is the right approach. And I think Elon was just where like basically someone was rich enough that like didn't need consensus basically, and was able to say, yeah,
and they cared.
And he, you know, and even in his case, like it, like he had to get debt, like, you know, he had financially, you know, like back the thing. And I think Gumroad was sort of small enough. I had enough, like I was a solo founder, so I still had enough of the company that basically today, like, I can kind of just do whatever I want. And I think that's pretty powerful. Like, I think when you see, and I, you know, when I look at the markets, like Zuck and now Meta stock's doing pretty well, but you know, he's like, he needs to be the captain. Like no one else, like if he leaves, Matt's screwed. Because there's nobody, like at that point, there's nobody who's going to be able to do anything at that company. Right. And so you can, I think if you're, you know, in a certain direction, you can like hire somebody and they can go, you know, keep doing that, you know, at an accelerated pace or something like that. But yeah, I think you're almost like starting a new company at that point. You need a founder type figure. You need, you need to do these sorts of things. And I've thought about it. Like I've thought about, okay, now that Gumroad is decently profitable or will be this year, like, could we go implement this at other companies? Like, could we buy a company and like, as collateral and go buy a company that's similar to Gumroad in this way, a Patreon type company, you know, that might have like, you know, 400 million in their prep stack or something, you know? Who knows? But again, like for me to want to do that, like, cool. Now I have to go raise how much money now, right?
It also like there's conflicting incentives in the sense that the more high profile and the richer you either personally is, like in the case of Elon or something, it's like the more options you have. So you really have got to care about that single thing. And that is sort of that you were at this point where there was a relatively, and I say this in a neutral fashion, like a relatively low value of your time in the sense that you're not a super billionaire with incentives driving in the right direction and bam, and you hit it. It makes me wonder if venture capital did do this for their companies that they no longer gave a shit about, whether it would destroy some of the incentives for founders to work hard, or if that's what VCs would say. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is an interest, like I would argue like the OpenAI funding is a little bit like this, where it's structured in a way where it's like, hey, if this doesn't 100x, that's built in, like it's kind of built into the model in a way. I don't know. It's a different approach. I think it's kind of interesting to think about, like, what if I raise money and you get, you know, up to 10x and then the equity goes back to the, like there's a way to do that. I think Ultimately, the game just works because of that one company that becomes worth $1 trillion.
Yeah, the power law.
Everyone is so focused on that in the industry. And I consider it almost kind of like a religion or something, that like it's really about finding that and reading that and contributing to that and getting a chunk of that. That like even investing in companies, it's like, did the company get sold to one of those? You know, like it's such a big piece of your returns. And that like anything that's like hard work or requires a lot of time, it just paled in comparison to like, well, that's not getting us to that. And so I think you may see those things in like finance or private equity where you'll go buy, and I actually respect the crap out of the businesses where they like go buy. And by the way, like that industry is way bigger than venture because they do a lot more real work, right?
Of those deals, right? Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Well, those deals are absolutely massive.
That are tough.
And they have to actually due diligence, and like there's a lot, it's real like adult work, you know. And you know, like a friend of mine, like, you know, Perks has been like, you know, managing Hooters, right? It's just like,
sure,
owning that thing and trying to increase value in that thing. And I do think maybe it's a maturity thing where you'll get more of that happening. Maybe founders who want to operate but not start, you know, like have liquidity will say, hey, we'll buy like a bunch of these and roll them up or something like that.
You need to have,
frankly, like you have kids and it's just like, why bother? I'm doing well enough.
Right.
Yeah. It's, you need to have to be a repeat operator and to know, and to, cause what you learned, I feel I'm projecting maybe a little bit, cause I've had the same experience, is you start kind of VC, your VC-ish career, as in when you're running a business with essentially like no guardrails and no sense of how to do anything, maybe. And then it's like, here's this big pile of cash, use it wisely. And you're like, okay, you know, and you don't really know until you've made a certain set of mistakes. Now, what I would love to sort of dig into is this phase where it fails. Because, you know, according to Tom Lavero this week on Twitter, and according to everyone else on the internet at the moment, it's like a big company apocalypse is coming. And you did an incredible shrinking that allowed your self-serve thing to maintain, and you allowed it to give it that time. Now, maybe lots of companies are about to go through this, maybe not, but certainly they could appreciate your wisdom on how to do it and what is really essential. So that's sort of like my first question. And then I'd love to talk about that, the sort of 10% thing down the line. But first, what is really essential in that type of gigantic cut to essentially make the product and the business survive?
Yeah. Well, I think layoffs are one of the hardest things, because what doesn't get talked about in a lot of these articles that get written up about layoffs is that, like, it sucks for like no one wants to do it. It's not like we hired these people for fun, you know, like we spent a lot of time, interviewed a lot of people, and considered these like the top 1-2% of the people we talked to, like, did God visas. Like, there's just so much involved in building a team. And I think this is one of the reasons, maybe the top reason that, like, you don't, like, founders deny that they need to do layoffs or should, is because there is that sort of cost. And then there is the human and emotional cost of doing it as well.
Right.
But I think that the critical thing is to know, like, who is actually, their work, their contributions are effectively are actually driving value for the business.
Right.
And I think just tons of people in these organizations that, if you are growing, if you are, you have low CAC, or maybe you can justify a lot of positions, a lot of recruiters or sales people or customer support people or engineers or designers even. But when you look at what is it like, and in the case of Gumroad, basically what I realized was basically nobody was really contributing to the growth, in the sense that we had built this product, right? We had put it on the internet at a URL. And I did that in 2011. And of course, we'd shipped tons and tons of features over time. And we emailed people to use the product. And we did all these sorts of things. But imagine if you just, let's say, like, no one can shoot, like, the code base froze, right? Yep. It froze at Gumroad, it froze at Twitter, whatever. Like, it would just basically continue doing its thing. And, like, as long as we basically answered, like, support email, like, it would kind of continue to do that, right? And so I just, you know, you just look at the business and say, well, how do I justify employing anybody, in the sense that if there's no discounted cash flow math you can do on their contributions, generate cash, you know, to discount, like, then what's the point, right? Like, and in startups, there's this, I think, idea that, you know, you're building all these features and the market is growing and, you know, there's this war that you're playing with competition you maybe don't even know exists. And so there's some value to doing it. But I think the truth is, like, there, you know, like Google, you could basically delete 99% of the code base and Google, you know, Alphabet would make this roughly the same amount of money. And what is valuable? What is, how do you, if interest rates go to 100% and there's, like, you just value based on, you know, who's, you know, just the capital for this year, you could let basically everybody go. And in the sense that, at the end of the day, what are we doing? We're just, it's just software, right? It's just HTTP requests that we're responding to or whatnot. Right? And so I just think a lot of founders don't really consider sort of the black swan for their own company, which is, like, you could literally go back down to 2, 3, 4 people.
Yeah.
And if you are free product market fit, like, you might want to do that.
And yes. Yes.
That you have, like, 10 amazing engineers or an amazing designer, like, all these amazing people. But at the end of the day, if they're like putting in all this work to build something that nobody's actually using, it doesn't really. Like, it doesn't matter. And you're basically just spending money, right? Like, you're just spending money that is, like, for no real point, right? And I just think that it's a hard truth that I had to encounter, you know, sort of by force. Like, I didn't want to do layoffs. Nobody, you know, wants to do it. You kind of get put in a position where the market is, like, you're getting hurt so badly, or, like, company, that you're kind of, you're forced to do it, which probably means that these layouts people have been seeing should probably be more drastic. Like, generally, it's unlikely.
Right.
They're too dramatic, right? Like, no one would say that they're too dramatic. There's just too many reasons for them not to be. But yeah, I think that's the big thing, is to realize, like, who is actually contributing to the product? Is that anybody?
Yeah.
Then what is the point of the business? Like, at the end of the day, what is Gumroad? Gumroad is this, you know, Excel file, which is like revenue from Stripe, revenue from PayPal, you know, and then, you know, Amazon servers, you know, fraud, whatever. And that's the business, and everything else is
right.
like contributing to that, one of those numbers in some capacity. And the reason to hire people is because we have cash flow. So we want to improve the product because we have users who, you know,
you have competitors as well.
And we have competitors, and there are reasons to improve the product. But for example, in a sort of 4.5% interest rate environment, like, is it worth burning, you know, for example, last year we did about $185 million in GMV. We lost about $1.2 million. So like, and we did about $11 million in revenue. So it means we effectively burned $12 million, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the question is it worth burning $12 million or $1 million, however you consider that, for basically Gumroad to not grow involved? Like, it is nice that we shipped a bunch of features, but at the end of the day, like,
sure,
how many features should we ship? What's the math here, right? I think basically that math, when you have a 0% interest rate environment, so it's sort of unbounded. And so you, as long as you can justify raising capital, you know, and at these two valuations, it's like,
right,
how many people do we need? Well, as many, like, and basically as many amazing people as we can find, because we just want to ship as possible and blah, blah, blah. And it's just a completely different switch on, like, oh, it's actually about the balance sheet. Like, that's our product to investors.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
It is.
You're like, you should be able to see in a 0% interest rate environment, you pay someone $100,000. You make $101,000 off of them. You're like, that sounds good to me, or something, right?
Yeah.
Something, right?
Especially if that increases the value of the company that you can use to give people stock options.
Right.
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 Mm-hmm.
I will take kind of the other side, because I've been through both types of companies. So Ship, I would say, is very similar to what happened with Gumroad. Like, it definitely was not a venture, like, scale, a backable company. Like, we just, there weren't enough people that we solved a great problem. We had a great product, but there just wasn't enough people to have a venture backable return. And so, like, we were coming up, we had a big engineering team, big product team, and we were just kind of like trying to make the product better, but that didn't actually drive incremental growth. But on the other side, in Airhouse, and I'm feeling the pull from the market, and I'm like, there's so many customers that are basically like either unhappy because we don't have X, Y, and Z, or won't sign on because we don't have this product or this thing, or we're not in this market or something like that. And so I'm really feeling the pull of like what you see from some of these other like actually venture scale companies. And it's real. Like, it really is. It's like, me personally, I'm getting stretched too thin because I'm dealing with a lot of the product stuff and all of this. And we need to really grow because we have that like pull from the market. And that's what like the venture capitalists are. These are the types of companies that are, I'm going to push my own book for a second. These are the type of companies that the VC is they want to really back. So it does obviously exist, right? You look at like the Airbnbs and the Googles and all that. But then you definitely do get to a point where it's just like incremental improvements. So your example with Google, like once they built like the double click and they had all of the stuff integrated in their search, like that's the majority of the revenue. But to build all that stuff, you do need a lot of people. Sometimes depending on the business, but there can be like this really huge pull from the market. And that's what I would consider like product market fit. Everybody throws this term loosely around, but it's really like, I definitely feel it now in this company. And I felt the exact same way that you did with Gumroad with Ship. And I was just trying to make it work. And I was trying to like slim down and keep the operations going and all that. And I couldn't get it done. I think we had too many investors. We were talking about a recap. We tried to get new investors in and it just wouldn't happen. So I was like, well, I'm just going to start a new company then. So there is obviously there's two sides of that, of what can happen, to that. So that's my experience.
I'll add my two cents into it. Breather had a $120 million, prep stack.
Oh, you get the most. All right.
Yeah,
you win.
Yeah, that's no, I don't think it's a competition in the way that you think it is. But it was it was working, but not in the way intended. And I will say all the investors tried really hard to reduce the pref stack, were willing to go through things. Like, keep in mind, a lot of this is happening during COVID. Like, I wasn't CEO at that point, but I was still on the board. And so when lots of investors want to make it happen and still believe, and that's kind of like the weird part of the business, that the last business that I started, is that everyone continued to believe,
right,
from a market size perspective. And so, but everything really needed to align. And the reason, and I actually still believe it today, but it's not us, obviously, it is that a quote unquote Airbnb of office space was possible.
Right.
And I think that everyone was trying to drive towards that. But that's like a magical little place where everyone is saying there is a giant pref stack, but we do want to keep working. And yes, we should raise another round and like all this other stuff. But holy shit, does everyone, if anyone is pushing the brakes on it, like it's not going to work. So it's just remarkable what needs to happen in order to keep one sort of misstep from fucking the company, so to speak.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
There's a teacher in animation. I took this animation class when I moved to Utah, and one of the teachers said, you watch these bad movies and you're like, why are movies bad? Like, like, why would we make a bad? Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
Just make it good, you know? And he was basically like, making a movie is a miracle. Like, a bad movie is a miracle. And so when you see a good movie, it's sort of a miracle of miracles. And I think it's similar, where it's just so hard to even succeed in any way.
Right. Yeah. Right.
When it worked in a nice way, you know, where it's like Kleiner and like all these things have to happen correctly in the context of running an actual like real business too, that if we're able to kind of thread the needle and get to this sort of magical place, like Airbnb for office space. But like, everyone knows there's a way to get there and it exists. But getting, you know, just like electric cars, right? But it's like, okay, then you need supercharging, all these pieces need to work for it to actually happen. And you're also competing with anyone who wants to compete with you.
It's complete,
free market. And so you have to do it in a way that, like, you know, makes sense for the business. And every investor has different time horizons. So you have kind of business for them at that point to get to the next stage where you're the right business for them at that point. And, you know, you go from like raising money from like angel investors to like Saudi Arabia. And like, it's the pool of capital go from $1 million to $1 billion. You know,
Yeah.
It's
what's the size of your fund is what you would ask someone at that stage. And to be like, well, this is an $800 million fund and we've had 500 of them or something before those. And
depends on how much oil we decide to make.
It's up to us, really. We decide how big the fund is. Just as a side note, before we go into another hard decision, and it's actually like kind of a good theme maybe for this episode, but this space, this quote unquote creator, I don't like that phrase, but the space of solo people creating a thing and creating an audience, there's a lot of people in that space that have gone the I never took venture path, or I took a little bit and then stepped off way. And I'm wondering if it's inherent, you believe that it's inherent to the industry that it takes way too much time and that venture is not going to support it well. Do you think that, and maybe I'm sort of overfitting, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just too expensive in terms of time, mostly, and talent, you know, therefore to make content that's valuable. And you're basically, when you're sort of a CPM business and, you know, you basically make all this content, you can get millions of impressions and then Twitter gets to monetize that.
Right.
Or TikTok gets to monetize that.
Yeah. So, YouTube. Yeah.
Or YouTube. And it's a weird, and really truthfully, like the way that most of these creators, if you look at the GMV of the real sort of creator economy, which is probably, you know, TikTok and YouTube is probably 68% of that or something.
Right.
It's brand sponsorship, right? It's basically advertising. It's just the same model of TV, radio, Super Bowl, right? Which is like a bunch of people tune in for entertainment, you know, between the ages of, you know, or whatever. And then you sell them, you know, like Pepsi wants to advertise their product to them.
Liquid Death.
Liquid Death, exactly.
And so
you know, unless you somehow are going to become, you know, like Taylor Swift or something, it just doesn't really make sense for investors to invest in that kind of stuff. Like, it just, you know, you're never going to have that return, you know? I think this is always a problem with NFTs and crypto and stuff too. It's just like,
right,
you can do it and it's, you know, and it's, you can have a lot of fun doing it. But you know, the minute you start thinking of this, like, oh, there's a business here where I can invest in these kinds of people, and you know, it's unlikely. And I think it is just a repackaging of this thing that people have been doing for a long time, which is you're showing people how they can make money on the internet, right? Just
right.
Basically,
yeah. Right.
Starting WordPress blog, and you know, like doing these like recipe websites, right? It's just this, mm-hmm. just 25, 40 years later, it's now, you know, being on Twitter and building an audience, doing threads, teaching people some skill, selling a PDF or a course, or, you know, Discord access, or, you mm-hmm. know, some sort of Google sheet of some crowdsource list of XYZ thing you can arbitrage, and all sorts of like value creative stuff, I think.
Right. Right.
But it is like all this, like this weird, like dark matter of the economy.
Right.
It's like all these 1099 workers who basically can't work 9 to 5 and are like, how do we figure out how to make a living? Any other way to, and to be honest, I think it's quite similar to entrepreneurship in that way, and startups. Mm-hmm. And
totally, it is entrepreneurship, as a matter of fact.
How do you compare that to, and obviously this is very relevant to the business that I'm in, but like to Shopify, for example, like how successful they have become, like they're in the creator business as well. They sell hard goods mm-hmm. versus digital goods. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think Shopify is just a way better business than Gumroad and most creator economy companies, because they help people sell. Yeah. And the reason is that they help people sell physical goods. And I really like, this is, it's sort of a chip on my shoulder in a way that like I work purely digital economy where I can't go to, I can't see my work in a way, you know? And like, I just think when you look at roads and like real stuff, there's just value to that. And so I think Shopify basically can do 1,000x the GMV that we do roughly,
right,
because they help people buy, you know, sell things that you would buy for, you know, Christmas presents and stuff like that. And so that is just a much larger sort of term, I guess, right? Where you're helping people mm-hmm. sell socks and clothing and furniture and like all sorts of stuff. Digital, selling digital products. And I think this is one reason I think the sort of tech industry has sort of, you know, come off the highs so strongly, is because I think we assumed many more people live online and consume online and digitally than actually do, that like most of the world is still lives in a very local, community centric way, as
right.
their number, has their Target, has their Starbucks, sits in drive through, you know, things like that. And not everyone lives in SF or New York or, you know, where these people making the news and Twitter and tweet, you know, like generally live. And so anyway, I think that sort of like makes everyone think the creator economy is like this massive thing where it's just all these people offering content for, you know, billions mm-hmm. of people effectively for free, you know, because it's fun. The other thing I think that people don't, and this is only something I've really grokked, trying to understand like all of this new Twitter behavior that's been happening, because I think there's much more focus on just like the algorithm rewarding engagement purely, and realizing that the vast majority of the creator economy is basically the targeting a very specific age group, which is basically helping people get onboarded. Like, it's sort of this coming of age where people are figuring out the internet for the first time. And there's like mm-hmm. And I think this is like actually like social media largely is like before you have kids, you know, after you graduate college, you're in this phase of like career success optimization. That's when I think you spend so much time on social media, and like, that's why Twitter has this like educational how-to DIY vibe to it, and TikTok and all these things. It's like really focused on those kind of people who also buy products. And so they make really good, I think ads as a business model actually is the right way to monetize.
Yeah, totally.
That's interesting.
Selling digital content it's useful, and people will do that. And I mean, mm-hmm. you know, my career, like my, you know, equity revolves around people continuing to do that, but it will always be small, I think, compared to just the fundamental business model of what Google figured out, which is if you know that the customer may want something, you can just get some, you know, physical products people buy, right? And
right,
so just,
right.
just mm-hmm. physical products in front of digital content, and that might be, you know, an interesting way.
Or services, digital services as well.
Or services, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Local. Like, I mean, most people spend like almost all their income within a very small radius too.
Right.
So right. Local advertising. I mean, this is why Google and Facebook are such amazing businesses. It's just really, what do people, generally use the internet for? It's like, you know, finding local services.
Yeah. Do we want to go into, I'm really interested. So
this is great. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. This is really good though.
You've done a lot of stuff. So you're building in public. I know you hold public board meetings. You've done crowdfunding for Gumroad. You also have your own fund as well. You're investing, and you're most likely looking for venture type returns as well, I'm assuming. You also invested in us, so hopefully I'll be able to return that. You also made this, it was really interesting, and had a lot of noise on Twitter. You increased your prices. So do you want to take us through that? I know they're now at 10%. You take 10% of whatever your creators do sell for, but there was a big backlash, at least publicly. What was it before? What did you jack it up to? What was the reason? And like, what was the outcome?
Yeah. So before it was previously this tiered based pricing structure where it started out at 9% plus 30 cents and it would go down over time to about 2.9 and 30 cents. So basically as cheap as Stripe, and the goal being once you make $1 million on Gumroad. And the theory behind that pricing was at some point you're going to churn unless we, you know, you're going
to
go.
You could go to Stripe. You could go to Stripe. Stripe's the lowest. Right. 2.9.
You just optimize for that. And if once you make $1 million, you would assume that these people have that incentive or whatnot. Right. And so that's kind of where I think we put that pricing in place maybe 2020 or 2021. And before that, we had something different, but it was roughly similar blended. Most people were probably paying about 6.5% for Gumroad. And that included Stripe fees. So all
right.
of that.
Was so like included. Three.
So really, yeah, Gumroad was making about 3% or so. And what I decided, and this was triggered by a lot of things, but, you know, really just recalibrating, like seeing the interest rates and figuring out, okay, going back to the balance sheet, like what does Gumroad need to look like to be a valuable company? And the way that I sort of defined that was we need to be generating a few million dollars in profit per year. I think that is fair for how much GMV we do. And I'm going to sort of reverse engineer every other number based on getting to that point of about, you know, 5 million in net income off of about 185 million in GMV. You know, I think that's pretty fair. And so, and we can optimize from there, but I think just, you know, getting the increasing the top line to kind of make that happen. And so, yeah, I kind of like looked at the numbers and I realized, and I talked to some creators and I realized like basically no one was really looking at the price that like we were trying to optimize.
Interesting.
Basically, you know, taking care of Stripe and like doing these fancy tiers and retaining people. But the truth is like, if you want to sell PDFs, you use Gumroad. If you want to start a premium newsletter, you use Substack. If you're a YouTuber and you want to connect, you like use Patreon, right? Like there's just these, or Bandcamp or Itch or for video games or whatever. Like there's these categories now for these different marketplaces. And the value is so much in that network effect, in that social consensus.
Right.
And I would talk to a creator and like basically over time learned that like pricing had zero impact. And, you know, the economic term for this is like price elasticity or price elasticity, right? Which is like how much will demand change based on the price of the product? Effectively realizing that like prime ribeye or something, like people will continue to buy it. Right. And then I looked at the other options and I said, okay, Substack's 10% plus Stripe. But people pay it. You know, Patreon goes up to 12% plus Stripe, Bandcamp 10% plus Stripe, et cetera. And so I was like, this seems like they're getting away with it. If this seems, you know, and it did seem high to me, to be honest. I was like, this is aggressive. Like we're going from 6.5 and ended up being about 12.5 now. So almost double, right? 89. So it's a big jump. But at the end of the day, I said, you know, if someone's making $100 on Gumroad, would they still use us if they kept, you know, $87 if we automate the rest?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, instead of them making, you know, $93, they're now making $87. Right. Like, well, I mean, to me, it felt similar enough that like, even if,
yeah.
we, And the math we did internally was if we saw 20% churn, it would be good. If we saw 50% churn, we would still be in a better position.
Wow.
Wow.
We were increasing our pricing that dramatic.
Yeah. It's interesting. Today, yeah.
Not 3% churn. So we've seen.
You said 3%? Three?
Churn. Yeah.
Wow. Oh.
Sorry. Is that users or is that from a GMV standpoint?
GMV. So we've seen.
Wow. It's inconsequential.
Yeah. And to be honest, those people were probably not, like, they were at 2.9 anyway. Right.
You know, because Sahil, like people just are shouting about this thing.
Right? Yeah.
Which is crazy.
But they're still staying on.
I guess so.
It's funny because, you know, it's like, if you just look at Twitter, it's, you know, these are the same people who said maybe Twitter, or maybe not the same people, but similar, I think, reasons that lead to people saying Twitter is going to die. Because
right.
4,000 people mm-hmm. go.
Yeah, because the people in my timeline think that they will die. Right.
Exactly. Where there, mm-hmm. I think there's just this, like, very deep emotional reaction.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's totally right.
One is that there's this emotional reaction of, like, oh, I'm used to paying 3% or 4% or 5% for Gumroad, and now I have to pay 12%, and, like, that sucks. It's just, like, a mm-hmm. very emotional reaction. And then I think there's just the sort of, frankly, like, incentive, like, a rational sort of incentive of social media of, like, these people mm-hmm. are building audiences,
right?
They're constantly looking to do that, to find things to tweet about, educate their creator, their users, their followers on the creator economy and things like that. And, like, Gumroad is now, like, you know, enemy number one for the day, right? Where we're literally, I mean,
interesting.
There's, like, we did nothing good. We said our pricing is going up. There's no more tiers and we no longer cover Stripe. Like, bad, yeah. bad. You know, and the right. email I sent to people was like, I think the first sentence was, we're updating our pricing to be simpler and higher. And then I just right. like, these are the changes we're making, you know, Stripe, this, that.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, you know, thanks for using Gumroad. If you leave, and this is what I say in the email. Yeah. Like, you can go read it. It's on, like, screenshotted all over Twitter, right? And it's like, you know, we think that this is still worth it. You know, check out the board mm-hmm. meeting if you want to learn what we're doing and blah, blah, yeah. blah. And if you leave, you know, like, that's not, but, like, yeah. at the end of the day, like, fine. And people, don't want to hear that, to be honest. I think
yeah.
it's like, no, the reason they're shouting is because they don't want to leave, right? That they
right. Like, right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's also, like, you also didn't say why. You were just like, it's increasing. See yeah. you later.
Yeah. And this is something I sort of learned maybe being on Twitter, which is, you know, you give an inch, that sort of thing. Like, they're going to.
You gotta.
Mm. And so I just said, like, going into this, the first sentence needs to be, say the price is going up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows these emails you get that are like, pricing update.
The leads at the very bottom. You gotta
along like over the years we've shipped these features and it's so blah, 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 like, and then like click, you know, and then it's like our fees are going, you know, whatever, right? And
mm-hmm.
I was just like, I'm gonna write an email that's like, the worst thing about getting canceled on the internet is when they get the story wrong.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Everyone was canceling me for something incorrect, right?
Mm.
So you're never gonna be able to crack the record. Like, it's gone forever. Like, that's what the internet believes, mm. right?
Yeah. It is great because it's interesting. I'm really, you're making me, because I'd only read the stuff on the internet, right?
Yeah.
The fact that your GMV churn is 3% is actually that's like kind of like
a little
explosion in my mind, but it's, you know, because we've all gone through this. Kevin, you've gone through some kind of price increase. I have increased price deliberately, I want to say 5 times last year, over and over and over again, testing the market. Every single time, there's someone on your team that is freaking out, right?
Yeah.
Someone on your team is like, we're going to die. And every single time, totally. You have a set of people in your business, customers or prospective, even if they don't even pay. And they're like, I liked it before, even though I didn't pay you, or I paid you and I cancel. And now I don't like it, which means I was paying you zero then and I'm paying you zero here now again. You should change it. And you know, and they yeah. have equal voices on the internet. And it's,
it is like, I do think the reason people protest is because things would not change otherwise. And so mm-hmm. it almost needs right. to be this like,
sure.
very angry sort of, you know, Gumroad is going to die because the only way you're going to reverse your change is if you think that. And so maybe if 12,000 people shout this at the same time, you will change your mind. And that it works. I mean, there's instances where that works and it should work. Like, there are probably mistakes that were backtracked or whatever, right? But yeah, for me, like, I kept going back to, we're now charging the same as Substack. And like,
that makes total sense.
Myself, like I didn't respond, like I didn't tweet that day. Like, you know, I was like, I'm not going to even respond to any of this stuff.
100%.
Because it's going to extend the thing, and I'm not going to apologize, and I'm just going to let it happen, and people need to grieve or whatnot, right? I just kept reminding myself anytime the other thing I do is like, who messaged me privately?
Right.
Like, if I was using, you know, if my HOA increased fees, I go talk to somebody in person or like whatever, right? Like, I would have a real dialogue. I wouldn't just go on Twitter and yell.
Right.
So I try to say, okay, who really uses Gumroad that I hope doesn't churn? Make sure they don't churn, you know, and then like, you know, that should sort of, if I have enough of a pool of sort of representative sample size, then I can like, probably means most people won't churn. And what I found is a bunch of people were basically, hey, I don't know if this is a good idea. You know, people doing maybe $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 a month on Gumroad. I would probably leave or consider leaving because it's, you know, it's a significant amount. And so it's risky, but you know, at the end of the day, you do, right?
Yep.
And I just sort of made a list and now look back and basically, you know, none of them churned because the truth is like Gumroad does provide quite a lot of value for.
Yeah. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is like in venture,
you know,
it is really well known in this space. Everybody just on the venture side, because I know because I don't serve your customer, but I serve a service professional that's a solopreneur, right? So they're also like the switching costs is why one of the main reasons new businesses don't succeed. And so they're just like, we really have to start over. Fuck it. A little bit. To it.
Yeah. I think there's a, you know, a long-term bet. There's a sentence from Mark Andreessen that actually like poked me in the side and I could like, it was like a thorn that I couldn't get rid of, which is he basically said that it's not that the best products win. It's that the winners become the best products because the winners get to charge more to like have the best business models to attract the talent who wants to work on the best business models. And almost like self-fills into the best product where like maybe Google wasn't the best, but because it won, become the best. Or
that is a super astute thing to say. There's a version of that that I heard from the founders of HubSpot. I was watching a talk and they were like, our product was shit for 10 years is what they said. And we just got better and better. And now our product is good. And I was like, holy fuck. And it was bringing me to this idea because very community oriented type of product and thoughts and like customers. And it's the other thing is like when you're serving that type of customer, community is like a really big one, which is why I'm surprised that you just said, yeah, this is the price, as opposed to we love the community. We serve you. We respect you, which is, I think, what some of your competitors essentially tried to pull your GMV out with. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, I probably was a little like sort of harsh or blunt about it, but.
Yeah,
it's like show, don't tell, right? Like at the end of the day, the reason people use Gumroad is not because we're lovey-dovey. It's because they think we have the best product.
Yeah, yeah.
It has high.
It's rational.
It's generally a rational decision, which means if they use it because it was cheap and it's now too expensive, that's also rational. If they think it's still a good deal, it's all. Like everyone is roughly acting rationally. And part of that is like presenting irrationally on Twitter or whatever, right? Like there is all this like.
That's a good point.
This 4D chess of I'm making $100,000 on Gumroad and this is going to cost me $10,000 a month unless maybe, you know, it's worth trying to do a viral tweet thread.
Try to make them change it.
What if I went down to, and to be honest, and you know, the thing I never like really said on Twitter is like, look, at the end of the day, you have to understand why we're increasing the price, right?
Right.
If you want to convince me, you know, like you have to understand the intent, which is, I want to make like Gumroad wants to make more money. And so
to serve you better.
You have to.
We're business.
We're a business. We're trying to now make more money. Why? Because we can no longer raise at stupid high valuations because of 0% interest rates. But like at the end of the day, Mumford is now 12 years old. We provide a service. We're sort of post-product market fit. We've been post-product market fit for quite a while.
Right.
You know, I've done like $100,000 of secondaries. Like I would like to at some point make some money on this thing.
Sure. And that's funny.
I could go sell it to private equity for like $50 million, make 20, and then it would do all sorts of horrendous stuff.
That's right. Yeah, they would raise price again. So
they would basically do what I would, what I did. Hopefully I did it better because I want government to develop over the next 10 to 20 years. So changing pricing to 30%.
Right.
Just printing money for the next 5 years and then writing it off, right? I'm trying to get to a place where it's sustainable. I can now hire more engineers. We can build a better product. We can build in a GPT. These things that all these other competitors, and frankly, you know, the other thing is like, just like there are other competitors sort of like commenting about this press and trying to do things like, you know, saying, oh, you know, you can be cheaper and all these sorts of other things. It's like, look, we're at the end of the day, I tried to do this too with Gumroad,
right?
Where I ran a super...
Super lean.
Oh man.
But it's the best product that wins. That's the thing.
Stripe payment links exist. And if you want the lowest, cheapest pricing, you can get 2.9 plus 30. And so even if we did, frankly, go to 5 or go to 7 or whatever, I really did feel this existential threat of like,
of course,
I hear you.
Stripe is just going to build the features or do this or that. Or if they don't, we should be charging for the delta, right? Because inherently otherwise they're using Gumroad for some reason, then we're not.
But you know. I think this is a really good lesson for any of the founders that are listening. Like you really should be, it's because the cost of providing these services is like very low. Like it's like, as you mentioned, Zell, like it was yourself and like you had AWS or GCP or whatever is running the background. And that's all the costs you have. You should charge for the value that you're providing your customers, and they will pay that.
It's the other thing that I'm really drawing from it is when you cut super deep. You just described that.
Yeah.
And now when you're raising by price, you're raising big, as opposed to let's incrementally wah.
I think the lesson is kind of like it's first principles based, right? Which is like, how many people do you need now? Not how many, like delta negative, you know, 5% or 10%. It's like, how many people do you need now? Like what should Gumroad charge now? And there's, you know, it's basically based on cost fallacy. And to your point, you will have people in the internally, you'll have people on the board, you'll have all basically everybody is like, this is not a good decision. This is a big risk. Like, what are you doing? But the truth is like, you're
3%.
It is the numbers speak for themselves, like super low. It will probably, you know, still happen over the coming months. But at the end of the day, if you were the CEO of Gumroad, right? Like, again, like, no, you know what I'm trying to do here.
So right.
If you can, you know, you can suggest better things. And at the end of the day, suggesting 5% is basically like, instead of 10, is basically like saying we should take a $10 million revenue hit.
Yeah.
Right.
And anyone that wants to do the math on these numbers pre and post can easily do it and see what the difference is on your bottom line. Oh, right. Yeah.
You can see hourly GMV revenue and you can see 6.5%, 12.8% or whatever.
And figure out what business you would rather own, work for, or start or what.
Yeah.
I want to close with your thing, Flexile. Is that how you pronounce it?
Flexile.
Yeah. And so talk to me, it must have been, you felt this pain of bringing onboarding people on contracts, all these other things. Now you're like, I'm launching a thing for my own problem that I'm experiencing. Does that resonate with you?
Exactly. Yeah. Basically I felt this pain of we're onboarding all these contractors all over the place, all over the world. We have about 21 people now. At COVID peak, we had about 45. And it's just a pain. It's just manual. We're using PDFs, bill.com. And I just felt, like I want to build a new product. I don't want to start a new company.
Right.
I have engineers and designers and government doing well. Like we have some resources. Like what if we built a new product to solve this other problem? And in some ways, it's very different from Gumroad. It's a completely different client base. We're not selling to creators. We're now selling to like remote startups. But in other ways, it's very similar. It's like a two-sided marketplace. It's these 1099 workers who are outside of this sort of traditional W-2 economy. So there's like, metaphorically, it's sort of rebuilding a lot of the same infrastructure. It feels very similar. But yeah, it's sort of a new thing. And I think that the sort of conceit is that basically I'm not a huge fan of 9-to-5. And I'm like, how do you get more people to work, you know, outside of those hours? And the creator economy is one place that that exists. And I think Flexile and flexible work, which will basically be, you know, product designers, engineers,
right,
customer support people, fraud risk, product management, marketing, overtime, sales, right? People probably billing $50 to $150 an hour for all these remote startups. That's kind of the economy that we're trying to build. The flexible economy, I guess, is kind of what we're trying to coin, I guess. But, you know, just this, all of these people who are kind of freelancers. And the cool thing, the thing that I would love to see happen over time is equity for all these folks. And so they all
earn right.
Even if they're not full-time employees, they still, you know, get some equity in the companies that they bill for. And then they have a portfolio of companies. And so instead of right now in startups, there's equity. And, you know, a lot of people end up doing well when these companies do well. But outside of startups, one of the worst things about the bootstrapped, I find one of the things I don't like as much about the bootstrap community is like basically when the companies sell, the founders get 100%.
And
like,
yeah.
You know, employees, you know, they this game of like VCs suck or whatever, but then it's like,
well, I've noticed that. Yeah. All of them do that, right?
Right. I like MailChimp or whatever. It's like they get
MailChimp, Basecamp or.
Yeah. And it's fine.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like one reason is because stock's a pain in the ass.
That's not a good reason. That's not a good reason.
So anyway, that's what we're trying to do with Flexile is like, hey, you just set it up and say, hey, you know, this product designer is working for Gumroad 20 hours a week, $100 an hour, you know, 100% bonus in equity every quarter.
Right.
And everything is kind of automated. And then the last thing that I would love to figure out, and this is kind of new, is dividends. And so actually figuring out like if Gumroad
was cool,
how do we, you know, we have 7,300 crowdfunding investors. We have 70 people on the cap table. We now have contractors. Like, how do I like effectively actually just like to sustainable to me means no exit in sight. And that means dividends, basically. It's just once we get to, you know, the pricing change kind of has enough quarters, you know, to kind of just like take over the balance sheet, we have a business that just cash flows. The goal would be to start doing dividends and just distribute back to shareholders, myself, early employees, my, you know, contractors, the crowdfunding investors. Our last round was 100 million. I think we could probably do about 6 million in dividends this year. So it's about a 6%.
That's great.
Yeah, you know, it's not bad, better than T-bills.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's I'm just trying to figure out like what is the you know, again, I don't like working 9-to-5. And so can I take all these pieces that are required in terms of hiring people, you know, and give them equity and dividends and like build products so that I can just wake up in the morning, check my phone, approve, you know, and then go about my day. So anyway, that's Flexile.
Love it.
But we'll see. It's definitely a bet. I mean, it's definitely like high risk.
Yeah.
Like how
many but you have a timeline, right? Like your timeline is you have decided, it sounds like you have a philosophy. Your philosophy is give things a certain amount of time, work on them, but give them the time that they need to be able to do it. And you've placed your bets behind them.
Yeah. And I believe that the market is the sort of determinant force here, right? Where Flexile succeeds, it will mostly be because there was a market need for it. And it, you know, a lot of companies were going remote, trying to save money, trying to hire globally, leaning down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Flexile was the sort of default solution people decided to use for that. And on, you know, the flip side of that is like, if it doesn't work, basically it's because like everyone just used Deal. Like there was another default that existed.
Yeah.
That was the one. And they just, we weren't able to crack our own thing.
And they are heavily venture backed.
Yeah. And our view is very different. We're like, we don't do any W-2s, any benefits.
Right.
Commit to this way of working, you know?
Right.
And that, to me, that's the risk factor. Like how many companies work like Gumroad or want to.
Right.
And the whole
or could.
maybe in, you know, more could, and 5% interest rates, like more might need to.
Yeah.
And yeah, so we'll see how.
But we're going down. We're going down. We're going to lower interest rates. So come on, everybody, stay together.
He was like, I got to do secondary at some point.
Chop, chop.
Well, I think we're at time. Why don't we end on that? That's great. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope everybody learned some stuff on this. Thanks for listening.
Second Time Founders Podcast, talking tech news. The show is a must, not some billionaire trying to sell you their book. We're coming from a real place, plenty ups and downs, got some insights. Join the discussion now. We being honest and raw, giving you real talk. We've been at the bottom and made it happen and much more. The Second Time Founders Podcast, more building, less talk.